Welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a career prosecutor in the Savannah, Georgia area. We're continuing our series on the murders of J.R. and Mary Crocker at the hands of their family. We left off the last episode with the Crocker family moving to Georgia in February 2012. Initially, the Crockers lived with Kim Wright, her boyfriend Roy Prater, and Mark Wright, who was Kim's son and Candace's brother, at a home on Cobblestone Circle in Effingham County, Georgia. Within 1 month of the Crockers' arrival in Georgia, the police had been called about a beating given to J.R. by Mark Wright, Candace's brother. There are numerous accounts of this event, but we will start with the one given to police. Police were originally called to an outlet mall because J.R. was seen by a mall patron shivering outside without a coat and with bad bruising on his face. Security at the mall spoke to Kim and to Candace, who said that J.R. was fine. They claimed he had been punished the night before, that he didn't need a jacket, although it was a cold day, and that Kim didn't want J.R. to come in the store with the family because she believed he would steal things. The explanations given by Kim did not satisfy the mall security officers, especially in light of the severity of the injuries to JR's face. They figured out where JR had been injured and reached out to the Effingham County Sheriff's Office for a follow-up. On March 4th of 2012, the story given to investigators was that JR, then just 11 years old, had mouthed off the night before. Elwin was unable to punish JR because Elwin's arm was in a sling, so Mark Wright, a 25-year-old man, was asked to inflict the punishment. Descriptions of the actual beating varied, from Mark claiming that JR had taunted Mark and said that he could take whatever Mark dished out, to Candace saying Mark beat JR until Kim told Mark to stop. Roy and Elwin, Roy Prater, the boyfriend, and Elwin denied seeing the beating, and Kim was vague about her knowledge, but accounts agreed that Mark had not pulled his punches on this malnourished 11-year-old child. More importantly, officers could see the impact of the insignia on Mark Wright's ring on JR's face, even 24 hours after the beating. The imprint was still there. Mark Wright was arrested, and DFAX was called. Here was the first opportunity for Georgia authorities to intervene for these children, and on paper, what happened initially made sense. The Crockers and their children moved into a trailer away from Kim, Mark, and Roy. Ironically, the trailer park was named Brother's Keeper, and we'll talk about that more in the next episode. Although the trailer belonged to Mark, it was a condition of Mark's criminal bond that he had no contact with JR. The aggressor, Mark, would be kept away from JR, which should keep JR safe, right? Are you thinking, finally, is something's going to be done? You can imagine that JR was. But as anyone who has worked child abuse or child welfare cases knows, this was just the tip of the iceberg. No one in a position to take action seemed to clock some important facts. Number one, Elwin, JR's father, wanted to beat JR himself but couldn't because his arm was in a sling, which is why Mark did it. Two, not one of the adults who witnessed this beating or the injuries to JR thought there was a problem. And three, all of the adults blamed JR for his injuries and for Mark's arrest. There were even more signs. In early interviews, JR took the blame for being punished and said he was wrong for whatever he might have said, which no one could actually remember. JR, without prompting, totally out of the blue, told investigators that he gets fed and that he has enough food. When asked if Mark had done anything to JR before, JR told investigators that the previous summer, Kim had Mark beat JR with a metal rod, leaving welts on his legs. JR told them, the investigators, He had told his parents about it, and his parents had done nothing. Hundreds of pages of documentation reflect government agencies and providers' involvement with the Crockers over the next year. The picture they paint of what may have been the best year of J.R.'s short life is hardly clear and isn't always pretty. Think Picasso and his Cubist period. Guernica comes to mind. You may be wondering what I mean by that. What I mean is that there's a lot going on under the surface in the records, and clues to the fact that J.R. was walking a tightrope between the punishment his family was inflicting and the image that the family wanted to project to these government agencies occasionally bubbles up throughout the documentation. Early on, the family's powerfully negative view of J.R. is obvious. Every single adult at Cobblestone Circle believed J.R. deserved to be beaten to the point of visible and pronounced bruising. And all of them were furious with J.R. over Mark's arrest. Elwin and Candace immediately refer to J.R. as Jeffrey Dahmer. They claim J.R. terrorizes the other children, and the whole family is afraid of him. 3 months into the DFACS case, providers are being put in place, like counselors, therapists, and medical providers. Even though the Crockers are living at Brother's Keeper and the family is claiming that Mark has no contact with them, Kim and Roy are still actively involved in disciplining JR to the point where they are furiously demanding of the DFACS case manager to do something about JR kicking the back of the car seat. When they are told JR's actions don't warrant him their big reaction, Kim and Roy contemptuously leave, suggesting that the case manager's approach of timeouts should be ignored. JR is also continuing to be punished for things and in ways that make no sense. He has a room in the mobile home, the one a Brother's Keeper, with no bed, just a futon on the floor. There are no toys or decorations in the room, although the other children have themed decorations in their living spaces. Candace says that this is because JR punched holes in the wall, but there are no holes. Candace claims JR has hurt the younger children, but neither the children nor the doctor that examines them can see the injuries Candace claims JR inflicted. JR is allowed to go to Vacation Bible School, which he clearly enjoys. He's made to recite what he learned every day, but he is unable to perfectly recite the entire week's worth of scripture. So Candace and Ellen keep JR home from the last day celebration at Vacation Bible School. No one seems to think that there's anything out of place with this. As providers get involved in play therapy for JR and parenting education over the summer, Elwin repeats to them that JR is the devil and will kill them all in their beds. Elwin is adamant that he doesn't need parenting classes. As the providers work with the family more, it becomes more and more apparent that there is tension between the providers and supervisors, who are skeptical of the Crockers' progress, and the case manager, who is clearly trying only to see good things. For instance, the case manager takes Elwin saying he knows what it is like to feel bad as a sign that Elwin is empathizing with JR and considers it progress. As the kids got back into school, there were still signs of things being amiss in the home that were overlooked or written off as he is their child. For instance, it was repeated and reported that JR was spanked for eating cheese sticks at school, and that cheese sticks have sugar, according to Kim, which she claimed JR was not allowed to have. We're going to talk more about Kim later, but Elwin admits to withholding food from JR to manage JR's behaviors. And this is not simply a medical issue. Keep in mind that JR was being medicated for ADHD and excelling at school, and in November 2012 found to have an IQ of 126 with well-managed behaviors. Any negative behaviors from JR at this point are those reported by Candace or by Elwin? There are reports that Kim is taking JR places, but no one asks any questions, like where is he going? What are they doing? Around November 2012, significant changes are noted with the Crockers. How much of this was simply optimism on the part of the case manager is hard to tell. But JR finally gets a bed. The school has got breakfast and lunches in place for the Crocker children on school days and snacks sent home on weekends. This is important because Elwin had pulled JR out of the school lunch program not once, not twice, but three times, according to the documentation. They wanted to control what he ate. Parenting classes got ended in November. The reasons listed for their not needing parenting classes anymore were: one, there's no disclosure of abuse. In other words, the kids have not disclosed anything. Two, the children report their needs are being met. And three, JR is described as being happy at school. Good enough. It's worth noting still that there are still telltale signs that in hindsight, things were not quite right. Through October and November, first Elwin and then Candace have what appear to be significant medical issues. Now that DFX has gotten the Medicaid in Georgia, Elwin has gallbladder surgery, which puts him out of commission. Near Thanksgiving, Candace claims to have broken her wrist and ankle at the store. There's no documentation of this, but she is unable to walk and is unable to cook Thanksgiving dinner. JR has been told that he cannot go to Thanksgiving dinner at Kim's because Mark will be there and Candace can't cook, so JR is not going to be part of the Thanksgiving celebration. I want to take a moment to talk about the pain medicine-seeking behaviors of Elwin and Candace. It's something we'll come back to, but throughout this year, where we actually have some idea what is going on in the home, neither Elwin nor Candace can hold down a job due to various claimed maladies. Stomach problems, unable to, and that's Candace, not Elwin, unable to walk, backs hurting, things like that. This is significant in part because Candace mentioned that the night that Mark beat JR, Elwin was passed out on pain medication. It is important, too, to think about what the school did for these children in this year. The school made sure that the kids had a great Christmas. They made sure that presents were delivered and a Christmas tree. And JR was grateful, reporting to the case manager that he had the best Christmas ever. And then in January of 2013, DFAX closed its case. I do want to pause here and talk about JR for a moment. Who was this boy? We know very little about him, but what we do know is that he was not the monster the adults in his home life made him out to be. When JR first got to school in Georgia, the staff was concerned that he was underfed. He was, as the few pictures we have of him show, small and very thin. The staff at the school were worried because JR would eat the small lunch that he had had sent with him, then eat out of the trash. When staff members brought food, JR ate it ravenously. JR was put on the school lunch program, but first Kim and then EJ took him off, EJ being Elwin, took him off, claiming JR has diabetes. There's no diagnosis of this. JR exhibited urinary incontinence at school, and even as late as November 2012, it was mentioned that JR wore overnight diapers. Malnutrition can cause urinary incontinence, but as you will see, the adults in JR's life blamed him, as they would similarly blame Mary. In school, JR excelled. He was in the honor chorus and making good grades. Despite Candace and EJ's claims, no provider saw any fear in Mary or the Crocker's youngest child when they were playing or interacting with JR. In fact, one of Mary's friends later reported that Mary and JR would play with each other and others like normal kids when they were allowed to. So had the family really changed? Not much, according to Candace, especially not much when Kim was involved. While Candace is not a chronological narrator, and we will discuss the treatment of JR when DFax was out of the picture in greater detail in the next episode, JR's punishments did not disappear just because DFax was involved with the family. According to Candace, even before the police were called on Mark, Kim had had Mark impose punishments on JR. Initially, they were things like digging holes in the backyard or holding his arms out at shoulder height to wear him out. Eventually, though, Mark would tie JR's arms and legs out like a spread eagle standing up in the garage at Cobblestone. JR would be left there for hours like this, and sometimes he was whipped. Once he was left out there overnight, sometimes JR was left there naked. So while DFax was involved, were things better? Hard to say. We know Kim and Roy sometimes, quote unquote, took JR places while DFax was involved. And as you'll hear, once DFax was out of the picture, things went downhill drastically. But throughout DFax's involvement, the food deprivation continued at home, though not at school. As Candace put it, they tried to do what DFax told them as far as praising JR to get DFax out of the picture. The adults told the children to lie to the providers because what happened in the home needed to stay in the home, according to Elwin and according to Candace. JR would be taken to Kim's and punished, and though Candace tried to hide it, even in her interview with the police, Mark was involved in those punishments too, and no one was doing a physical examination of JR's body after a single medical appointment in June of 2012, and even that has limited records. So how could DFax just drop out of the picture? All too easily, especially back in 2012. Throughout its history, the Department of Family and Children's Services goal has been to reunite families, even families that seem irretrievably broken from the outside. As a system, it has been completely overwhelmed with cases since its inception. The services provided here would be considered family preservation. Create a plan to keep the child, JR, physically safe first. Since the assessment on the scene did not even seem to consider that any adult other than Mark Wright was a threat to JR's physical safety, no one gave any thought to removing JR or any of the children from their parents' care. Nowadays, that lack of protective capacity on the part of Candace and Ellen might have raised more eyebrows than it did back then. But the fact that they didn't intervene on this child's behalf was completely ignored. The laws in place, which became a lot more stratified in 2014, gave a lot of discretion to a single case manager. That person would decide what services would be needed, sign up providers, and try to ensure that the family was actually complying. But whether things were good enough for government work was almost entirely their call, and there was no mandatory number of visits that they needed to make. Many of these case managers, even now, go into the field with limited education, limited training, and a to-do list a mile long that includes things like listening to the hold music provided by Medicaid while the case manager tries to verify that an application has been accepted. For multiple families with multiple special needs people on many occasions. So it's understandable that a case manager would look at this family that at least is capable of filling out forms on its own and think they're salvageable. But were they? And this case manager was just as motivated as the Crockers to get them off her list, making her, the case manager, easy to manipulate. So after JR's one good Christmas in 2012, DFax was out with no follow-up. The next report to DFax was not until March of 2017, after JR was already dead. When a child reported to the school counselor that the child had seen Kim beat JR, leaving injuries on him the year before, Because of that late report being a whole year late and the lack of an immediate threat to JR, the complaint was screened out immediately. The fact that there were two other children in that home, completely ignored. No one even bothered to check to see if JR was okay. And let's face it, after all, DFX had only ever been concerned about physical abuse of JR. As you will hear in the next episode, DFX's attitude of "it's their child" allowed for 3 more years of horrific torture of JR. Yes, there is more. Stay tuned.